I'm in the middle of a project that is completely absorbing. It's hard to get away from it. I can't really quite believe it, but I'm already halfway through. When I was at Felsentor in Switzerland, I noticed in the library that they had a book that said Sando Kai and Deshi Maru. And Deshi Maru was the bishop of Soto Zen in Europe for many, many years. He trained with Kodo Sawaki at the same time that Koban did, and they knew each other. He was just as wild as Kodo Sawaki, as far as I can tell, maybe even more so from how I'm reading what he's written. I looked in the book immediately because we were already talking about studying Sando Kai, and it was all in German. So I thought, I'll go home and look it up on Amazon and get the English version, but there isn't an English version. So I've been translating it from the German, word by word by word. It's an amazing process, because I don't really know German at all, though I'm catching on. It's amazing. You can learn a language that way, I find. They have dictionaries online, so you can just line up the dictionary on one side and what you're writing out on the other and just keep flashing back and forth. And it's such interesting material. I think that's why I forget to eat while I'm doing it. It's that interesting. And of course, Sando Kai itself is so interesting. It's about the mind of Buddha, the mind of the great sage of India. It's intimately transmitted from east to west, and then talks about how dichotomous the world is, how it feels so broken up into good and bad, right and wrong, up and down, all the different ways that we can, with our kind of mind, experience the world. We don't experience it as one seamless whole. It's all bits and pieces. And bits and pieces that have value, that we evaluate as what we like and don't like, want and don't want, all of that. I was mentored as in a poetry group many years ago. There were a bunch of old ladies in Los Altos who wrote haiku mostly, and they welcomed me into the group, even though I was very young compared to them. And they kind of helped me along in writing in a wonderful way. And as the lady who was in charge of all of it became a friend of mine, her mind began to go. And before she completely lost it, she went into a stage where she started keeping a notebook and writing down all the opposites. And it was page after page after page. She was so entranced, she'd suddenly discovered that that's what her mind did. This and that, up and down, in and out, fore and aft. It's... when you really start to think about it, it's amazing. Join the circle, please. A chair is okay if you'd rather. Let's introduce ourselves so that we...
I'm Jane.
Great.
David.
Julie.
And Angie. So I was just talking about a friend who, as she was losing her mind to old age, started keeping a notebook of all the opposites, the up and down, in and out, back and forth, black and white, good and bad. She got completely entranced by the whole way that her mind was working, and that there was a word for it. She was a poet, so words meant everything to her, her whole life. And that was the way she sort of went out of the thinking realm. It's very interesting. That comes up for me over and over, being a word person myself, for one thing. And for another, so aware of how driven we are by the way that our mind works, that we, our tendency is to choose one side or the other, to want one side or the other, or to proclaim one side or the other. There's always a way of raising the flag for the good and putting down the bad, and without realizing that they both come out of the same mind. It's the same thinking that's happening in both cases. When we sit, we see it very clearly. It becomes a kind of torture sometimes, the things that come up that we want so badly or that we feel so strongly about. And yet we begin to see that we can see through them. But the truth is that we're just sitting in the sitting hall. We're just breathing. We're just being wherever we are. We're not involved in whatever the project is or the drama is that our mind is telling us about at all. It's all made up. So we begin to see through that. Meditation is a tremendous gift to us that way. And yet we do tend to cling to one side or the other. And usually the good side, though not always. I remember once when I was new to Sesshin, new to doing retreats, really had been sitting about a year, and I thought, I'm getting it now, I'm understanding it. And about 2 days into a retreat out at Hidden Villa, I looked up and a whole flock of birds was flying right across the sky, all together. They were all going in the same direction in one body. All of them together. Wow, I thought, that's Sangha. Sangha is all these beings who have gathered together in this way, and we're all flying off together. We all completely are in sync with each other. So we had a chance to ask Koban questions during one of the discussions, and I asked him, what's Sangha? And he looked at me real hard, and he said, sometimes it's like a bottomless garbage pit. And I felt like he'd just gone whack. Whoa! No, it's this wonderful ideal. Everyone is flying together. So I think practice is very, very good for us in that way, because those of us who come to practice, I think, are fairly idealistic usually and are trying very hard to make our lives better. Understand our life once, for once, and to better them in some ways. It's the best place to come for that. It's wonderful. It works. But it's also an illusion. And it's important to remember that. Not to get so carried away that we begin to think that it's perfect in the way that we imagine it to be. It is perfect, but perfect in a very imperfect way. we think of Shakyamuni Buddha's life as a perfect life, but if you read the sutras, you see what an awkward, messy kind of thing it was for him. And because he was willing to meet with anybody, he was banqueting with kings, he was sitting in a stable with a shepherd, he was dealing with a cousin who wanted to kill him, he was having dinner with a courtesan, meeting a murderer on the road. There's no clear way of talking about good or bad in terms of his life. It was a life. And he accepted whatever came. There are times when I think we would not have accepted, but he did. Practice is really, really simple, our kind of practice, including your kind of practice, which is really the same.
Yeah.
And it's based on meditation and precepts. And the precepts are to help us wake up to how things are. We cannot not kill. We really cannot not lie or steal. We are taking. We can't own anything, but we're always taking here and there and everywhere. Every time we open our mouth, we can't nearly reach the truth, even though sometimes we try really hard. It's all, in a sense, a lie. All the precepts are that way. We can't glue them onto ourselves and make us okay. They're not coming from on high to glue on to us to make us okay. They're our deepest wish. And our guide. Sometimes people lash themselves mercilessly because they've broken a precept. It's really amazing to take them one by one and just see how often we break them. The one about lying is wonderful. If you take that into your life for a week, you'll be amazed how often you want to lie. Protect yourself in some way. Oh, I'm not really like that. Or, I don't want him to see me like that. Oh, no. I'll just tell him this. And it's so tempting, so tempting. But having the precepts, there's an extra layer of mind at work. The layer of mind that's attending to what the mind is doing rather than just letting the whole thing go on automatic. So we can't lie without knowing we're telling a lie. That's very painful. Sometimes we do it. Sometimes we put the brakes on and think, maybe I shouldn't do that. It gives a whole extra element of richness and generosity and kindness to our life that we don't have without the precepts. It doesn't make us perfect, but it opens us up to what we are and how we are and how we want to be. Not perfect. That's another dichotomy, perfect and imperfect. It's like you have to be either one or the other. In Western philosophy, there's that whole sense of one side, the other side, and then it's transcended and they merge in some way and become something else. In Buddhism, it doesn't work that way. It's just argued away. You can't really say it's all the way over here. It's so much thisness. And you can't argue all the way over here. It's so much thatness. You can't say. There's a middle place where we can't say. But where we can be, where we are, and where we live. We don't need to force ourselves. But if we can learn to pay attention, we'll begin to see how what I have, at least for the moment, translated as existence form, meaning all the bits and pieces of the universe, the stuff, is nirvana. How samsara is nirvana. That's really the whole point of Sandokai. That all these opposites, if they're embraced as one whole, can be seen as emptiness itself. That's what form does not differ from emptiness means. And emptiness doesn't differ from form. We have to say one and the other. And yet what it's saying is there's no one or other, it's the same. But it's not quite the same because it's one or the other. So it's, you can see how confusing it gets. As long as the mind is holding on to those ideas, as long as the mind wants it to be one way or the other way. And the sutra goes on to say at the end, after outlining and denying all of Buddha's teachings like a big eraser on the blackboard, that if mind is no hindrance, no fears exist. And then, it's not that everything gets wiped off or thrown away. It's just that one can live in the midst of everything without confusion. No fears exist, the sutra says. So in a way, you could say that we're cultivating wisdom in meditation, but wisdom that is enacted through compassion, by seeing through how things are, and not losing our connection with things, but being things as they are. When we chant the robe chant in the morning, we vow to be with all things. That's our version of saving all sentient beings. We vow to be with all things. That's easy if it's nice, but if it's a bottomless garbage can, then it's hard. And in a sense, it is hard, this practice. It takes a lot of guts to do what we're doing. Just to stay put on the cushion takes a lot of chutzpah. And to go out and meet our life, give ourselves to our life, that's not always very easy. And yet our life is so much more than we usually think of it. So much bigger. As I often say, we don't have to drive ourselves like we're a car. And even in driving a car, we feel like we're driving the car, but actually the whole thing is happening at the same time. And our life is the same way. There's a great engine of us. We don't even understand, really. We're being carried as we intend ourselves. So intention is very important, how we direct our mind. But it's also very important to give ourselves to what's happening, to the whole process. And not try to sort out whether it's a right thing or a wrong thing or a good thing or a bad thing. But try to take it all in. Just as we do when we sit. We can't sort out our thoughts as we sit. They just keep coming and coming and coming. But we can let them come and let them go. That's a very direct intention, a very generous intention. We can bow to our thoughts. We can bow to what happens to us. It's all of a piece. So that's what I brought to say today. When I finish the Sando Kai, I will give it to anybody who wants a copy of it. It's a very unusual kind of Zen talk. He's a very funny guy, Deshi Maru.
Is that the concept of nirvana? As like samsara, is that like, do people argue about that all the time in Zen circles? Like, is that like a controversial?
No, not at all.
Okay.
That was, okay. It's an experience.
I mean, but. If you say it, people could take you up on it, right? And
no, it's like talking about swimming to somebody who's never been swimming.
Okay.
Have to get in the water, and then you can talk about it, but then you're already agreeing because you both had the same experience.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, because like the Zen world is large. I mean, there's a lot of teachers. I mean,
yes, but everybody.
I mean,
right. That's a foundational experience in meditation. Anything else?
Yeah, I just want, Angie, you pointed out the indirectly that I'm a little different. I come from the Theravadan community and do Vipassana. I wanted to share that and say, hey, let's try this today.
Yeah, I sit with the Wednesday group once a month, usually.
Right.
So,
yes, and I know you from there.
Yes, and I know you from there.
Yes.
So there basically is no difference. Mm-hmm. Zen is completely based on all of Buddha's teachings.
Mm-hmm.
It's just extrapolated from that a whole other piece that I don't even know how to characterize it. That's a little, it just goes a little beyond what the basic teaching is. But when we talk about it and we practice it, it all sounds the same to me.
Yeah, it's like a different view of the same thing.
Yes. Yes.
And there's a fair number of Zen people in Boston.
Yes. Yeah. Gil being one of them.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes, my old friend Gil, who's a transmitted Zen teacher and also is a very powerful practicer of Vipassana and teacher, wonderful teacher.
Yeah.
There's a podcast, right?
Yes.
Listen to Google's.
There are a lot of teachings on the internet now. Tons and tons of teachings.
Could you talk a bit about that extrapolated part that, that Zen is?
Well, I think it happened, at least the story. There's stories about it, and I'm not sure anybody really knows because it was so long ago. But the notion is that after Buddha's death for some hundreds of years, the practice was mostly monastic. And that's what Buddhist practice was too. People ordained as monks and left home and became disciples of Buddha. And then monasteries were built, beautiful monasteries. And it tended to become, for a number of people, it became a kind of closed system where the practice was in order to become enlightened and leave the earth and never come back. Get out of here, get out of this samsaric world because it was so painful and difficult and gross and unreal. And to see through the unreality and cross the river and through the trees and be out of here. So that was the whole point of trying to get enlightened. And there were some teachers, some hundreds of years after Buddha, who thought that generosity and compassion were being squeezed out by this kind of practice and that it needed to be opened up. And Shantideva was one of the first ones to take that in hand and try to encourage people to develop bodhicitta, the desire for enlightenment, for the sake of others rather than for the sake of oneself. And to take a vow to get enlightened for the sake of others. And also, at least one version of the vow is to vow to come back over and over again until everyone is enlightened. So that's how it changed. It was a little tweak on the system of the teaching of Buddha, which was about generosity and compassion and wisdom. But human beings being human beings, it got a little bit too ingrown. And my understanding is that that's how Mahayana, so-called Mahayana, was developed. And then, of course, from there it became, the big emphasis became on meditation itself. Bodhidharma, the great meditator who supposedly sat in a cave facing the wall for 9 years until someone came along and understood that it isn't the teachings even or all the stuff that goes along with the ceremonies and rituals and things, that it's the actual experience of meditation itself. So it seems to me like Buddhism starts out very plain, just a bunch of people walking around in rags, practically, and then getting more and more complicated, and then coming back to being more simple, and then getting complicated again. And I think we've done that for over 2,000 years. And if you go to Japan, it's really complicated there. Zen is not this austere, plain thing that you think of. It's got golden dingle dangles in the temple and big red pillars and silver and big candles. And I mean, it's very, very fancy. Very well, Yoshiko knows that. It's complicated. We love to do that. We take something that's very plain and simple, and then we think, well, if we just add this little thing and this little thing, and pretty soon, I watch the Ekoji and see how they're sort of developing things that are very different from the way it was when I was there at the very beginning. And now they're saying, oh, we've always done it this way. And I know they haven't. It's so human. It's just what we do. And if we come back in 500 years, I wish I could. I'd love to see what Chikoji turns into.
it kind of sounds like breathing, you know. Like.
Yes. Yes. In and out. In and out. We just are never quite satisfied with the way things are. Always think it's going to get a little bit better.
I guess it's kind of what going, you know, that whole like nirvana, samsara thing. What I've noticed a lot is like, you know, practicers like just arguing a lot. Like,
online?
Yeah. I see. I'm pretty sure that's not limited to, I mean, I'm sure like a lot of like Sangha drama, so to speak.
What are they arguing about?
Well, just, on one blog, Brad Warner was talking about like the whole concept of leaving home.
Mm-hmm.
And people, I mean, reading his stuff, and there doesn't seem to be anything that controversial about it.
Well, it's difficult. That is one of the difficult questions for us, for lay practice. It takes a deeper understanding. If we're devoted to lay practice, which all of us are, home leaving means cutting home ties. It means actually walking out the door and not coming back. It means when you ordain as a monk, that's what you do. So if you're a lay practicer, then what does ordination mean? And Donna Lynn was talking about that the other day with me. And it's been my question for my whole life. How do I do this and raise my children for years? How can one leave home and not leave home?
See, to me, that question is, it's like the nirvana samsara thing.
Yes, it is. Like exactly. Exactly. But it takes insight to know that.
And then some people say, well, I have bigger insight than you.
I don't think you need to argue about it. I don't think it's anything to argue about. But it's a big question for people. Something that many, many people struggle with.
Mm.
But it is. It's exactly what you say. Yeah.
Could you repeat exactly what I wanted to get this word? You said precepts are. Wow, that's it.
A guide for us? I said they're a guide for us. They're to keep us awake to what we're doing. To remind us of what our own intention is. It doesn't always stop us.
When I heard the Sangha is the pit, bottomless pit of garbage, two things occurred in my mind. One I experienced in Japan, in Sangha. And the other one is that my experience of receiving support. So, both.
Yes, yes. That's the truth of it. That's what he was telling me. The birds and the garbage.
And when I heard your expression, like when we meet the world, real world, that's the place I feel challenged.
Yes.
So I have to bring the precepts.
Yes.
And at one point I have to make a decision without knowing everything.
Yes.
And there's no way to know everything, so it's okay. So I do my best to make a decision, and whatever it comes,
yeah,
I take all in.
So you trust. And it's not that you quite trust yourself, you're trusting the whole thing. That it comes the way it comes.
And that's beyond this.
Yes. Yes.
So I have to practice to remind myself.
Mm-hmm. Every day.
Every day.
Yeah.
Beyond.
It's beyond. It's beyond us.
Wisdom beyond wisdom.
Wisdom beyond wisdom. Exactly. Yeah. Jane?
If it's every day, how do we make progress as I mean as a people?
What people?
Humans.
How do we make progress with them? We don't.
But I see that we do.
Well,
awesome. Well, I mean, the way we support each other now, perhaps we did it the same way before, but just in different forms. But I see tolerance rising. Sure, this affects whether or not, but there's more openness. There's more of an understanding that we should help each other.
You're talking about the Sangha or life in America right now?
About and not just in America. So, I mean, or even scientific learning. I mean, we do build on what's come before.
Mm-hmm.
So it's. I mean, when we need that moment right now, we are a product of the cosmic conditions that brought us there. So there is. Our intention has been shaped, the health of our body has been shaped.
Yes, all those things. And our abilities integrate because of what's available to us. Yeah. Yeah.
So it isn't just.
But.
Well, there we go. I'm doing the dichotomy.
Yes. So if you start leaning on the notion of progress or goal, then you're setting up the dichotomy again, and you're not seeing the whole what's before you, because when something opens up over here, something is closing up over here.
So how does a Zen person even speak? or a steering wheel for that? How do we even speak?
From the belly.
And we don't worry about
how it comes out.
I wasn't going to say that. I
shouldn't
have said it like that.
What were you going to
say? about lying or putting somebody down or being ignorant about not progress and progress.
Yes. Well, you know, science, speaking of science, the scientific studies are proving now that the things that we do are done by us before we understand and know we're doing them. So if we decide to raise our arm, we've already decided in our brain, they can pinpoint it now, that we raise our arm before we raise our arm and say, I raise my arm. And I'm sure speaking is the same way. When we speak, the words come out, and then we know we said something. It's weird, really. I think in fact, that little ceremony with Koban, where he told me that about the garbage, is called a Shosan ceremony, where the teacher sits up like this, and people fire questions at him, bam, 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 and he has to answer, bam, bam, bam. And that's... we have one for students called the Shuso ceremony, where one of the hard things in Zen is to sit up and meet all your fellow students and answer questions like that. What is the meaning of life? Tell me, you know. And you have to learn how to let the words come. To let the wise words come. It's not just gobbledygook. It's that there's deep wisdom in us that, if we allow it, emerges. It's true of everything that we do. If we trust it and depend on it, rather than completely trusting and depending this part, you know, the intellectual part, which is a wonderful tool, but it's not nearly enough.
So is that why, when Bodhidharma sat in a cave for 9 years, that was a very helpful thing?
Yes.
I don't understand that. For himself, but how does that go into the world?
Because he was part of the world. Is a part of the world. Including the mind of the world. We say my mind, my body, but if you really explore that, you really can't put an edge to it.
It's just coming from the fact that we're not even moving...
Moving our own arm.
Yeah. That's pretty mind-blowing.
It is. It is.
There is a concept, I mean, in the precepts, the notion of atoning from past.
Yes, there is.
Could you speak more about that, I guess? I mean,
that's the first thing before taking the precepts. We do that little four-line gatha. All my ancient wrong actions arising from beginningless greed, anger, and ignorance based on mind, speech, and body, all together I now fully avow. It's accepting how we are before we take refuge in Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. It's accepting that this is, Koban called something, he said, sometimes I feel like a dirty rag. I think we all feel that way. We just It's, and yet we have to accept that, and that then we can take refuge in Buddha itself, and the truth itself, and the Sangha itself. The Sangha meaning all beings everywhere, including the moon and the stars. We take refuge in that.
All of them, whenever something comes up and then I cannot accept myself or accept it, I cannot accept the situation, then I take refuge. That's all what I heard right now blew my mind. I accept myself, then I'm ready to take a refuge.
Yes.
I never thought about it.
Can somebody actually accept everything about themselves? Isn't that another full area?
Only if there's a value judgment on it. If you just... Of course you do. You have to be very discriminating about a lot of things so that you do say yes to some things and no to others. You know, one of the vows is not to do evil, to do good. Those are the two basic vows of Buddha. So you have to know what's evil and what's good. And Buddha's second noble truth is to make that discrimination very carefully and don't do the evil if it comes up. Recognize it and please choose not to do it. And if good comes up, please cultivate it and do it as hard as you can. That was his teaching. So it's not that we obliterate dichotomy completely. It doesn't mean that.
I'm speaking from the from. I have a lot of trouble accepting myself as I am. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's one of the most painful things about my life.
Yeah, I think it's true for almost everyone.
Yeah.
There's a little girl who lived next door to me for many years, and she, from a very young age, she would say, she'd get mad at herself about something, and she'd say, I hate myself. It would hurt me every time she said that.
Yeah.
But we all do it. We all do it to ourselves.
Yeah.
And it's... In Zen, we have 10 precepts. And the last one is no abusing the three treasures. And it means don't abuse yourself. It's vowing not to abuse yourself in just this way, of being able to see that you yourself are the three treasures. How could you be anything else but that? Only you is looking out of your eyes. You're the only one, actually. Each one of us is the only one. It's the weirdest part of being alive of all. It's really bizarre.
You know what a bizarre thing means.
But that's why we study the self. Very, very carefully. To see through that misconception that's based on conditioning. So much of Dalai Lama was shocked when he heard that that was the way most people's minds work in the West. A bunch of psychologists went to him years ago and started talking about self-esteem, and he said, what's that? He had to be educated about it because he didn't know. He said, we don't have that here. We don't have lack of self-esteem. But somehow, the way our culture is set up, people come into adulthood feeling really bad about ourselves. That's why this practice is so important. Because if we sit, we have to see what's here. We have to see how much more there is here than what our conditioning is telling us. We've got other people's voices in our head. You know, that's the weird thing. It's not even our own voice, it's somebody else telling us over and over again.
My mom, my dad, my
yes, yes, I think we all do. And some of us had wonderful, generous parents, and their voices are extremely helpful if they were helpful. But the ones who gave us a hard time and made us feel small, we have to see it for what it is. It's just a leftover. An old leftover piece of junk. It's not true, never was true, and we don't need it anymore. Easy to say.
Yeah.
So is it conditioning? So I'm thinking about Bodhidharma and doing good on his own in the cave for 9 years. And I'm wondering if it's conditioning that says that, oh, well, he's just doing it for himself. He's not, you know, giving this to other people. Sure, maybe at the end, and that's what redeems it.
My own idea about it, and I don't know, you know, it's so long ago, is that I know that he went to China where Buddhism had been for a long, long time. And it became a kind of scholarly practice where you had to learn a lot, memorize the sutras, and do all the forms. But it did not have meditation in it. And when he got there, he felt that if people didn't understand that the whole practice came from meditation, that they were just way on the wrong track, that they weren't doing it. They didn't understand it, even though they understood the words or thought they did. So his was a demonstration. You know, this is how we do it. And it's remembered thousands of years later as being this radical thing that he did, is just to walk into the cave and sit down. And when he was done, he had 5 students. He actually transmitted 5 people. Ajo being the first one, the one who presumably cut his arm off and all of that, you know, all those made-up stories. But he had 5 students who then carried the Dharma into China and established schools.
But to do it for that 9 years, I mean, that was just an argument for this point of view, that there's... he's not helping anyone until he leaves the cage.
But yes, I see. Well, yes. And in fact, in the new Bodhidharma magazine, there's a story about a woman who was, I think, at Berkeley. I've forgotten. She's an American woman, very tall, very beautiful American woman who was studying the mind and the brain and got so interested in Buddhism that she went and met the Dalai Lama, and she'd had an experience of seeing a flower, really seeing a flower. And he said, you should go and do a 3-year retreat. And she did, and then decided that she would just continue being in retreat. So now and then she comes out and gives talks and things, but mostly she's living in a little hut in, I've forgotten, in India somewhere. Mary Orr said to me once, she thought that the lamas who were sitting in caves all through the Himalayas were the only ones keeping the world from blowing up. I often think about that. And I think our practice keeps it from blowing up, too.
Keeps me from blowing up. I think it goes to that notion of that all is, that sounds really lofty, but that all is one, like the actions.
Yep.
Even the minuscule little things that we think really make no difference.
Yes.
Even like washing the dishes, or you know, that has something mm-hmm. to do with keeping the world, you know, I guess a livable. Oh, I mean, that, a livable. It's a way of embracing the world, I guess. Maybe.
Yes.
I don't know.
Yes. Yes, you're right. You're right.
And seeing the totality of the good and the bad in us, it enables us to do good, because if we, it's just no longer, it's just kind of refusal to be separating
yes.
ourselves.
Yes.
So actions, it becomes a lot clearer.
Yes, and we can move more freely. We don't get hung up in, you know, in our own thinking. We can move. Nice discussion. Thank you all. Thank you very much.